Rose is coming to the plate. Let's document the story now.
Hard hit ball. That's the second baseman, Gilbert, and Pete Rose has done it. A base hit.
Pete Rose has 36. He's trying to tie it up. There it is. Oh, and is he delighted?
It's the story of Charlie Hustle. Pete Rose made hit after hit after hit in his 23 years in baseball, most of them with the Cincinnati Reds. In 1985, he broke the all-time Major League Baseball hit record.
2-1 pitch from Shaw into left center. There it is! Rose has eclipsed Cobb. That's number 4,192.
After that, he managed the Reds and compiled a winning record and four straight second-place finishes in the division. He was an active legend. But then, things fell apart. In 1989, reports surfaced that Rose was in violation of Major League Baseball's Rule 21D.
Jerry, we have obtained a copy of it. As you say, it is a thick copy. It's volume one of nine volumes. And in it, it says Pete bet on Major League Baseball and on the Reds. That is what baseball's investigator is saying.
For those of you not familiar with Rule 21D, basically, you can't bet on a baseball game if you're in baseball. Rose denied all the charges and refused to cooperate with the investigation.
I'm happy to look into the camera now and say I never bet on baseball and I never bet on Cincinnati Red baseball.
But by the end of 1989, Rose was hit with a permanent ban from the game.
The banishment for life of Pete Rose from baseball is the sad end of a sorry episode. One of the game's greatest players has engaged in a variety of acts which have stained the game. And he must now live with the consequences of those acts.
Commissioner Bart Giamatti there announcing the lifetime suspension. Rose would not be eligible for the Hall of Fame or ever manage again. It took 14 years for Rose to finally come clean. Here he is with ABC's Charles Gibson in 2004.
Did you bet on baseball?
Yes, I did. And that was my mistake, not coming clean a lot earlier.
Did you bet on your own team?
Yes.
In the meantime, Congress decided to take action against sports betting in general. In 1992, Congress passed the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, also known as PASPA.
Government should not be in the business of encouraging people, especially young people, to gamble.
If sports gambling is utilized for revenue, state governments, not just racketeers, will be defrauding the public.
The law banned states from authorizing sports gambling and conducting sports lotteries, although it exempted several states that already had legal sports betting. PASPA has been a part of professional and amateur sports for decades now. And then on Monday, the Supreme Court ruled PASPA unconstitutional. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and the end of PASPA is where we begin our show today. Daniel Wallach is a gaming and sports attorney and partner at Becker & Polyakov. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thanks for having me on.
So what were the original intentions of this law, and has it been challenged before?
PASPA was enacted in the aftermath of the Pete Rose betting scandal at a time when gambling industry was not as expanded as it is today in the United States. It was pre-internet, and the design of the law was to stop the spread of sports gambling. But as a political compromise, Nevada, Delaware, Montana, and Oregon were grandfathered under the original law because they had pre-existing, sports, gambling environments, and those states did not want to lose their entitlement to offer sports betting. So pre-internet, it was designed to stop the spread of sports betting, but 25 years later, everything has changed. Casino gambling is prominent in at least 30 states. And with the growth of the internet, the ability to wager online in illegal, marketplaces and illegal websites is unencumbered. So the law stopped being effective more than 20 years ago and has essentially, channeled all of this wagering activity to offshore markets where there are no consumer protections, and the gaming industry, the U.S. gaming industry and states and the federal government, no one can monetize it. So I think it's out of a desire to kind of move forward and understand the reality of today's times, where with a mouse click or an app or a mobile phone, one can easily bet.
Now, New Jersey was the state that presented the challenge. Why New Jersey?
In the last decade, New Jersey, among a number of other states, We're experiencing severe, you know, budgetary shortfalls, and the gaming industry, the casino industry in New Jersey, as well as the racing industry, we're going through some hard times. So the goal of the legalized sports betting in New Jersey was to sort of correct the budget deficit and save the racing industry in New Jersey. There have been several track closings, and four casinos have closed with competition from surrounding states. Atlantic City and Monmouth Park Racetrack were really facing a fight for their survival.
And I just want to clarify for our listeners, the Supreme Court in this decision allows states to legalize sports betting, but that's not the same as states legalizing sports betting, right?
Well, I think that's an important point you're making. The Supreme Court did not broadly legalize sports betting yesterday. It removed the barrier that had been imposed on state governments, prohibiting state governments from making their own policy decisions as to whether or not to legalize sports betting. So as a result of yesterday's decision, states are now free to make their own determinations. Some will keep it illegal, whereas many others will probably create a legal and regulatory environment because it's a huge moneymaker, and it will revitalize the casino and the horse racing industries of those states. Because as I mentioned earlier, at least 30 states now have vibrant commercial, you know, gaming environments. And of course, from the state tax revenue side, it will bring, you know, in most states, in excess of eight figures annually in new tax collections, as well as drive tourism.
And where does that, I mean, you mentioned the tax money. We're trying to figure out sort of where does that money end up going?
It will vary by state. For example, in Florida, the proceeds or tax collections on gambling revenues from slot machines, they will go to a general education fund to bolster and you know, create new educational programs and, you know, help schools. But other states may direct it to some general budget. Regardless, that is money, newfound money, that states can use in any way they see fit. And those determinations will have to be made by each individual state as to where to best allocate it. But certainly in some states, education is the main beneficiary of gambling, you know, tax collections.
Now, this is just specific to sports betting, correct? What about other sports outlets like the NFL, the NBA, the NHL? Where do they stand when they see a decision like this?
Their biggest the leagues have two concerns. One, safeguarding the integrity of their sports, because the worst thing that could possibly happen to these leagues is that there's a betting scandal or a match fixing scandal. So from the league's vantage point, the spread of state authorized sports gambling could be seen as problematic because states are going to go about things in, you know, different ways. No two states will be alike. And with sports corruption being so prominent worldwide, and, you know, you have a fixed match or any kind of a corrupt scenario, it could really undermine, you know, public confidence in the games. So what the leagues want to see is a more harmonized framework where states will have similar laws, you know, from one state to the other. But that is not how things are unfolding. So where the leagues see this headed ultimately is through a new federal law that will create uniform standards across the country, because one of the problems with sports gambling, unlike casino gambling, is that the activity takes place across state lines. It's cross-border, it's interstate, whereas dice games and slot machines solely confined to a casino where it can be much more easily regulated and monitored by state regulators. So for the leagues to be truly comfortable here, they will need to see some kind of a cross-border cooperation and information sharing and an early reporting system. And something like that works more effectively with an overarching federal framework than it does when you move from one state to the next to the next. Just imagine if our stock market, instead of being a national securities exchange, were consisting of 50 separate, you know, state securities exchanges. It wouldn't make any sense, and it would be inefficient and lead to, you know, I guess it would slow down the reporting and cooperation among stakeholders.
And also, just for our listeners, and some folks might be more familiar with what this is in terms of betting and on certain teams, but for those listeners who aren't, I mean, are we talking about something that could ultimately impact if I bet on a fantasy football or, you know, fantasy baseball league, or just, you know, is this small scale betting that would be affected, or is this, what kind of betting are we talking about?
We're talking about the whole big time business of sports wagering on all sporting events in all amounts, large and small. There will be no limits on the amounts of the wagers that can be placed. The higher the bets, the better. What states want to accomplish here is to capture as much of the illegal betting market as possible. I think you will begin to see what's common in Europe, which are in-play wagers. Instead of betting on the point spread before the game, an increasingly popular form of betting is to wager on the events as they unfold during the game. So if a team is losing, you might get better odds, you know, during the first quarter. So I think the betting is going to be very widespread and full scale with very few limitations other than certain kinds of exotic bets that might raise or might create, you know, risks of, you know, fixing or corruption, like who might commit the first foul of the game. The leagues want to place certain limits on the types of in-play bets that are made, especially those that are more prone to manipulation or control by a single player.
We're talking about betting here. So the question is, with this, who's the biggest winner and who's the biggest loser?
Biggest winners have to be the casino industry and the horse racing industry, because their venues will now receive an adrenaline shot of a new form of wagering that will draw in new customers, millennials. I mean, the racing industry has historically been associated with an older clientele. And when you introduce sports wagering at a thoroughbred racetrack or a harness racetrack or even a dog track, it's going to bring in new patrons, more patrons, younger patrons. So I think by and large, the gambling industry will receive a big time, long-term benefit. It will be one of the most profitable forms of wagering in those venues, not just simply because of the bets that are made, but because of the visitors that are attracted to your facility by virtue of having a sports book or having a big Super Bowl party or an NCAA Final Four event. You can create big events that are surrounded by the whole sports wagering enterprise. The sports leagues, on the other hand, will see the values of their teams and franchises grow, because the leagues are going to monetize this in, you know, every which way possible, through sponsorships, by getting a percentage of the betting revenues in each state potentially, and by, most importantly, selling their real-time data and statistics and live video feeds to gaming operators to power the in-play, you know, wagering environment. So the leagues and the casinos both are going to win big time. The athletes themselves, by virtue of having more revenues driven into the sports leagues, I think the average salaries will probably increase incrementally to correspond with the increase in revenues that the leagues receive. So the only people who are disappointed by this might be those who are opposed to gambling expansion and those who are concerned about the addictions and compulsive activity that might be generated by legal sports betting.
Daniel Wallach is a gaming and sports attorney and a partner at Becker and Polyakov. Thanks for being with us, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Mississippi could be among the first of a handful of states to offer betting in light of Monday's decision. In 2017, the state legislature passed a law allowing sports betting in a casino if it's legal in the United States. And Mississippi has long been on the forefront of gambling laws in this country. It was the third state to get casinos behind Nevada and New Jersey. Alan Godfrey is executive director of the Mississippi Gaming Commission. Alan, are you excited?
I am very excited. It's going to be a very challenging time for us, but I think it's a tremendous opportunity for us.
So tell us, who wins in Mississippi?
When sports betting starts, I believe it'll be a combination. You'll have the operators, we'll see more foot traffic, which will hopefully end up with more sales tax revenue and some gaming revenue.
Mississippi's been preparing for this in many ways, right? Tell us a little bit about the change to rules around sports betting that were made last year in the state.
Well, in 2016, there was a study group created for daily fantasy sports. There was a big push to have that legalized. There was a task force studied it. In 2017, the law was changed to allow daily fantasy sports. In doing so, the legislature changed some of the Gaming Control Act, which at that point, should the federal courts overturn PASPA, it would have allowed sports betting to be had in the licensed casinos. So at that time, it was really a moot point because of the fact that I don't think the Supreme Court was looking at it. But now that they have, it has opened up opportunities for us. And we have been preparing beforehand just in case something like this did happen.
And give us a sense of what the state of gaming is like right now in Mississippi. How many casinos are across the state and how much revenue do they generate?
We've got 28 licensed casinos centrally located in three locations in our extreme north Mississippi, extreme south Mississippi, and then some spread up and down the Mississippi River, which is where they can only be located. We went from a $2.9 billion industry in 2007 to a $2.1 billion industry currently. So our revenues have decreased with a lot of reasons why, expansion of gaming in many, many states. So, but we're holding strong at $2.1 billion.
That's not a bad number. And does any of that flow back into the state? And if so, how?
Well, our tax rate is the third lowest in the country. The state rate is 8%. And there's a local tax that is another 4%. So a cumulative total of 12% tax that goes back to the local funds and to the general fund here.
What are the attitudes towards gambling generally in the state? Is there less stigma than there used to be?
I would have to say there is less stigma, just basing that on the fact that the legislator introduced and passed daily fantasy sports. There's current talk of a lottery. So I would have to say that while we are still considered a strong Bible Belt state and very proud of that, evidently the sentiment has changed if the legislature has loosened up the laws a little bit.
And is there any concern among any folks there who might say this could open the door to addictions to gambling and other types of issues that haven't really been thought about yet?
Well, we have a self-exclusion program here for people who have a problem, who voluntarily come in. Will this increase? I would have to say this, that the games that are being played are probably being bet on somewhere now. Time will tell if we generate new gamblers coming in or if we just get gamblers that were going somewhere else to an illegal bookie coming into our legal casinos. I can't really answer that question.
And when can I make a bet on the Yankees in Mississippi? Next year? Next week?
I would like to think our goal is to have the sports betting operations, assuming the operators can build their sports rooms by the end of summer, August.
And any next steps for you guys as this with the recent news?
We are actively fine-tuning our regulations, preparing them to go out for public comment. We have been in conversations with other jurisdictions, meeting with them, and will continue to do so. So, yeah, our model is really very simple. It is the Nevada model. Our Gaming Control Act was taken from Nevada. They've effectively regulated sports betting since 1949, and I believe they're always willing to help us. So I believe we'll be talking with them more, going out to visit them in the near future.
Alan Godfrey is the Executive Director of the Mississippi Gaming Commission. Alan, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Have a nice day.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.